Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy, a bi-weekly podcast dedicated to the examination of conspiracy theory, conspiracy fact, and those who promote these theories. I will be your host, Mike Bowler, as I examine a conspiracy theory, applying critical thinking and skepticism to better understand and seek out the truth behind conspiracy theories.
The Pearl Harbor Conspiracies Part 2. Now, in the previous episode, I laid out the history leading up to the attack on Pearl Harbor, and hopefully this gives you a good idea of what was transpiring internationally that was driving Japan and the United States in war. So for this episode, I'm going to delve more into the origins of the conspiracies that is usually associated with the attack on Pearl Harbor and relying on the events that I laid out in the first episode of the series. So the first manifestation of this conspiracy, or that there was a conspiracy leading up to the attack on Pearl Harbor, can be best described as what did Washington know. This conspiracy would first manifest itself publicly in an article by John T. Flynn, published in the Chicago Tribune, September 2, 1945. This would be the same day that the Japanese officially signed the surrender agreements. While the headlines of the Chicago Tribune read that Japan surrenders, almost two-thirds of the September 2nd issue was devoted to John Flynn and an article claiming the Japanese were coerced into attacking the United States, and the United States had been reading coded communications and was aware of the attack on Pearl Harbor. And while this was the public pronouncement of this particular conspiracy, this has been simmering in the background as the United States was heavily involved in the conflict in Europe and Asia. Now, John T. Flynn is a very interesting character. During 1932 presidential elections, he had been an avid supporter of Franklin Roosevelt and the deal. But for some strange reasons, shortly after Roosevelt took office, Flynn did a 180 and proceeded to attack Roosevelt and many of his new programs. While there's a lot of speculation as to the cause of this, what seems to be most likely was that Flynn was trying to get a position in the new administration but was passed over by Roosevelt. So from 1932 onwards, and almost literally until Roosevelt passed away in 1944, Flynn attacked Roosevelt mercilessly in newspapers, writing books, forming organizations in opposition to Roosevelt's deal. And when the war started in 1939, was highly critical of the United States neutrality laws and modifications therein. The cash and carry legislation and the Lend-Lease Act was viewed by Flynn as an overt step to war. And there's some truth to that, because the United States had been heavily favoring the forces supporting France and Britain, their war effort. And when France was knocked out of the war in 1940, the United States stepped up its support for Britain with the Lend-Lease Act and various modifications to the Neutrality Act. The United States had also been actively supporting China in its war against Japan. And then in 1941, when Germany eats Russia, the United States would offer a Lend-Lease to the Soviet Union. And even with the United States' entry into the Second World War in December 1941, the United States continued to supply Russia and Britain war material, along with producing material for the U.S. effort. And in reality, Flynn was reflecting the general feelings of the American, with Japan's invasion of China and Manchuria, coupled with Italy's invasion of Ethiopia, the possibility of war in Europe was, again, a real possibility. And most Americans were fed up with the Europeans and their willingness to go to war. Between America's general rebuff at the Paris peace talks in 1919, and perhaps coupled with a number of Americans of German and Italian descent who still held close ties to their ethnic roots, there was a major influx of German and Italians that had left Europe and emigrated to the United States in the 1920s, and you would have a very strong Italian and German communities building up in New England and Mid-Atlantic states of the United States. And initially, these communities were opposed to intervening on behalf of the enemies of Italy and later Germany. So John Flynn took advantage of this resource, relying heavily upon the general anti-war feeling in the country and taking advantage of the East Coast intellectuals and wealthy socialites of York. Also, Flynn had access and was able to tap the Midwest Industrial Belt. Again, many of the wealthier corporate types were more anti-Roosevelt and anti-New Deal than anti-war. And thanks to Senator Gerald Nye of North Dakota, and his munitions inquiry, there were going to be no profits in dealing with the government providing goods and materials. So anything that was coming out of Washington to bolster American defense or produce goods that would be of military nature was never given priority by the various corporations. The Ford Motor Company, General Motors, and Hormel Foods were classic examples of major government suppliers that would actually either not produce or turn down contracts or even delay honoring contracts in lieu of producing more profitable items. And another major anti-war player was Henry Ford. Not only was Ford a major player in the automotive industry and created Ford Motor Company, he was a very vocal anti-Semite. Ford had bought into the Protocols of the Learned Elders of Zion and actually had published a version of it that he would give away to executives at the Ford Motor Company and sell to the general public. Ford would also use his influence as a major stockholder in the Detroit Free Press to print anti-Semitic articles and anti-Roosevelt, anti-New Deal news articles and commentary. Henry Ford was a staunch supporter of Adolf Hitler and was a staunch supporter of the Nuremberg Laws, also known as the Blood and Honor Laws in Germany, that excluded Jews from German society. And because Ford had manufacturing interests in Germany, it does create some questions how much Ford's support for Germany was based on Ford's anti-Semitism or the need to keep his factories open profitable. We are still dealing with this problem today, whether U.S. companies like Ford Motor Company, General Motors, who also had factories in Germany and relied on slave labor to produce vehicles, how much, if any, culpability in their involved Holocaust. Eventually, Ford would temper his anti-Semitism when he learned that Germany had been creating concentration camps in an attempt to exterminate the Jews of Europe. But before the war, Ford was a serious anti-Roosevelt, anti-New Deal capitalist, and even when the bombs were falling on Pearl Harbor, took no interest in converting to military production. So with John Flynn and Henry Ford, along with a number of other capitalists in the Midwest and in the Northeast United States, began to support various non-interventionist groups. The most popular of these non-interventionist groups was the America First Committee, initially formed as a group of students at Yale University. Chapters began to spring up in other major Ivy League universities and was really gaining a lot of popularity amongst college students. The AFC was established on September 4, 1940 by Yale Law School student R. Douglas Stewart Jr., heir to the Quaker Oats fortune, along with other students including future President Gerald Ford, future Peace Corps Director Sergeant Shriver, and the future Supreme Court Justice Potter Stewart. At its peak, America First claimed 800,000 dues-paying members in 450 chapters, located mostly in a 300-mile radius of Chicago. AFC gained much of its early strength by merging with the more left-wing Keep America Out of the War Committee, whose leaders had included such mainstays of America First as Norman Thomas and John T. Flynn. It claimed 135,000 members in 60 chapters in Illinois, its strongest state. Fundraising drives produced about $370,000 from some 25,000 contributors. Nearly half came from a few millionaires, such as H. Smith Richardson of the Vic Chemical Company, General Robert E. Wood of Sears Roebuck, Sterling Morton of the Morton Salt Company, publisher Joseph M. Patterson, the New York Daily News, and his cousin, publisher Robert F. Cormick, the Chicago Tribune. Future President John F. Kennedy sent a contribution with the note saying, What you are doing is vital. The AFC was never able to get the funding for its own public opinion poll. The New York chapter received slightly more than $190,000, most of it from its 47,000 contributors. Since it never had a national membership form or national dues, and local chapters were quite autonomous, historians suggest that the organization's leader had no idea how many members it actually had. Serious organizing of the America First Committee took place in Chicago not long after the September 1940 establishment. Chicago was to remain the national headquarters of the committee. To preside over the committee, the America First chose General Robert Wood, the 61-year-old chairman of Sears Roebuck and Company. While Wood would accept only an interim position, he remained at the head of the committee until it was disbanded in the days after the attack on Pearl Harbor. The America First Committee had its share of prominent businessmen, as well as sympathies of political figures, including Democratic Senators Burton K. Wheeler of Montana and David I. Walsh of Massachusetts, Republican Senator Gerald P. Nye of North Dakota, and the Socialist Party leader Norman Thomas, with its most prominent spokesman being aviator Charles A. Lindbergh. Other celebrities supporting America First was novelist Sinclair Lewis, poet E. Cummings, Washington socialite Alice Roosevelt Longsworth, film producer Walt Disney, and actress Lillian Gish. Architect Frank Lloyd Wright attempted to join, but he was rejected when the local board decided that he had a reputation for immorality. The many student chapters included future celebrities such as Gore Vidal as a student at Phillips Exeter Academy and future President Gerald Ford at Yale Law School. While the America First was really a powerhouse of anti-interventionism, it did fall into some trouble. Nothing did more to escalate the tensions than the speech Charles Lindbergh delivered to a rally in Des Moines, Iowa, on September 11, 1941. In that speech, he identified the forces pulling America into the war as the British, the Roosevelt administration, and Jews. While he expressed sympathy for the plight of the Jew in Germany, he argued that America's entry into the war would serve them little better. He said in part, "It is not difficult to understand why Jewish people desire to overthrow of Nazi Germany. The persecution they suffered in Germany would be sufficient to make bitter enemies of any race. No person with a sense of dignity of mankind can condone the persecution of Jewish race suffered in Germany. But no person of honesty and vision can look on to their pro-war policy here today without seeing the dangers involved in such a policy, both for us and for them. Instead of agitating for war, the Jewish groups in this country should be opposing it in every possible way, for they will be amongst the first to feel its consequences. Tolerance is a virtue that depends upon peace and strength. History shows that it cannot survive war and devastation. A few far-sighted Jewish people realize this and stand opposed to intervention, but the majority still do not. Their greatest danger to this country lies in their large ownership influence in our motion pictures, our press, our radio, and our government." So with the formal declaration of war against Japan following the bombing of Pearl Harbor, the committee chose to disband. On December 11, committee leaders met and voted for dissolution. In the statement which they released to the press was the following: "Our principles were right. Had they been followed, war could have been avoided. No good purpose can now be served by considering what might have been had our objectives have been attained. We are at war. Today, though, there are many important subsidiary considerations. The primary objective is not difficult to state. It can be completely defined in one word: victory." 4 days after the bombing of Pearl Harbor, America First disbanded, and all the members joined the war effort in various industries and capacities that they were capable of doing. But John T. Flynn continued his attacks on Roosevelt and in the government's effort in execute war. But Flynn's focus was more on the economic aspects, mainly in the home front ration programs. And Flynn remained fairly active amongst many of the anti-war intellectuals. Historians like Henry Elmer Barnes and William Chamberlain relied heavily on Flynn for information that Flynn had access to. He was very close to members of Congress and the Senate and was still receiving information from these sources. But Flynn's major contribution to the post-war conspiracies came during the campaign for the president election in 1944. Flynn came upon some information about the United States intercepting Japanese diplomatic coded messages. Flynn would eventually pass this information on to Thomas Dewey and his campaign. Dewey was a presidential candidate in 1944, and when he learned that of these coded messages, he had to decide whether to use this information. When Army Chief of Staff George Marshall learned of Dewey having this information, approached him stating that the United States was still using the purple codes to decrypt Japanese diplomatic traffic between Berlin and Tokyo. And if this was revealed, it would cause the Japanese to change their codes and we would lose valuable information on Japanese situation. Much of the traffic between Berlin and Tokyo concerned the deteriorating situations in both countries and was providing valuable information on the economic capabilities of both countries. Dewey decided not to use it since it could potentially damage the war effort and never revealed that he was aware of this information. Flynn would ultimately release this information in an article on December 2nd, and had been made front page news by the Chicago Tribune. This would be the same newspaper where it would be announced that the Japanese had signed the instrument of surrender in Tokyo Bay on the USS Missouri. Harry Elmer Barnes would then begin to write a number of histories on the war and U.S.-Japanese relations, trying to press forward the idea the United States had goaded the Japanese in war. William Chamberlain also wrote similar books on the subject and would form the basis of much of the conspiracy thought at the time. So through the works of Flynn, Barnes, and Chamberlain, this would form the basis for a United States knowing that Japan was going to attack Pearl Harbor conspiracies. So is there any evidence that the United States knew that Pearl Harbor was to be attacked? And the best I can tell based on the evidence, there's no indication of Pearl Harbor up to being a primary target of Japan against the United States. The only two indicators that may have pointed to a potential opening against Pearl Harbor was the bomb plot message and the Woods Exchange message. I talked about these before. The bomb plot was the request from Japan to its embassy in Honolulu to map out the comings and goings of U.S. Navy and Air Forces out of the harbor, and the WINS message was just a backup communications code in case of war occurring and putting the Japanese embassies out of communication so that they would be aware of where the war was, who was it against, and what was happening again. Again, these messages had no direct indication the United States was a primary target. The many conspiracy theorists like to use this as their smoking guns as to Washington knew this attack was coming. So if you take a really good look at the history leading up the attack, you see the Japanese very meticulous and worked out every problem that they would face attacking the Pacific Fleet and its anchorage in Pearl Harbor. And a year earlier from the attack, plans were started by a very select group of planners that was led by Admiral Yamamoto. Of course, as more details were coming together for the plans, more people involved. Eventually, the commanders of the task force and all the air groups were involved. Now, the military in Japan, along with much of the government, maintained very strict information security. Japan employed a special information security force that could almost on a whim have someone arrested and ultimately executed if any information was to leak from within the planning circles or with anything within the military. Foreign dignitaries were heavily guarded and were restricted in their travel. Lieutenant Commander Kramer, who would eventually be leading the cryptographic effort in Washington, spent 2 years in Japan trying to gain information on the Japanese Navy. Since he was operating out of the U.S. Embassy there, he was heavily monitored and on a number of occasions detained for trying to get too close to naval and military bases. So the United States didn't have a real good picture of the Japanese Navy forces and what it had at its disposal. They were even unaware of Japan's program to build two large battleships. If they were completed, they would have been the largest ever built in the world. As a side note to all this, while the United States was trying to gain information, much of the best information was coming from Claire Chennault's Flying Tigers, fighting the Japanese over China. The Flying Tigers was an independent mercenary group of ex-U.S. military pilots flying missions against Japanese air forces. While Chennault was providing Washington with a steady stream of flight performance data and tactics, the Flying Tigers also learned how to deal with the relatively new aircraft, the Japanese Zero, discovering that while it was a very fast and nimble aircraft, it was lightly armored, and the Flying Tigers found ways of dealing with these new aircraft. The American aircraft traditionally had additional armor and heavier weapons as opposed to the Japanese. This is the classic striking a balance between speed and survivability. But it was discovered that the American pilots would be better off not dogfighting the Zero, but get the Zero to chase one airplane and have a second one behind it take the airplane out. This information was sent on to Washington, but got lost in the bureaucratic shuffle. Now, while some sketchy information was coming out on the war with the United States early on in the planning stages, much was discounted as party chat. The Peruvian ambassador was chatting with a Japanese naval attaché at a party. It was revealed Japan was planning an attack on the United States, but when it reached Washington, it was dismissed as idle chatter. But as 1941 drug on, it was becoming increasingly clear that Japanese was not responding to the United States' diplomatic pressure to end its war with China. So when it was decided to begin to embargo military raw materials, Japan not only accelerated its plan to start a war with the United States, but also made moves against French territory in the Far East, and particularly this would be French Indochina. This would be today's Vietnam, Cambodia, Laos, as a forward base for operations against Malaysia, Singapore, and the Dutch East Indies. This, of course, would further strengthen U.S.-Japanese relations. So with all this going on, the United States is trying to figure out what is Japan's intentions, what were the plans, goals, or general intentions. on the diplomatic front. The Japanese apparently were stalling on the issue on their occupation of China. Cordell Hull was the U.S. Secretary of State and chief American negotiator with Japan, working with Ambassador Nomura of Japan to develop a solution to the China problem. But the main complaint coming from Japan was that Hull was not very consistent in his negotiations with China, and the Japanese had this general impression that either the United States was either stalling for time or had no consistent foreign policy in regards to China. Nomura was well aware of American public opinion on China, and much of what he saw was contradictory. The American people did not want to go to war with China, but yet the Japanese had been shooting down American pilots who had been fighting in China. So all this was doing is creating confusion within the Japanese government. So the decision was made to begin hostilities against the United States in November 1941. That would push back until December 7th, when they would attempt a diplomacy was initiated by the United States. But that would all fail. And in a way, Washington knew much of this because they were reading diplomatic purple codes, but it had not yet broken the Japanese Navy codes. Generally referred to as the JN-25, this was a double encoded cipher that not only did you need to know a five-number code group, but that in turn, you may need to know the code for something else. And up to November of 1941, the United States had only been able to crack roughly 10% of the JN-25 code. But on November 25th, the Japanese changed the JN-25. This was called JN-25B. So in effect, the United States went from 10% to zero overnight. So the only information Washington was getting about the Japanese Navy has been through merchant ship reports, island spotters, Navy patrols, and what they can glean from the lower priority messages that the Japanese Navy was using. Also an interesting aspect is that Japan operated two large radio transmitters that would beam out messages in the JN-25 lesser codes, and the Navy listened for ships replying, trying to judge from the amount of power the stations the return messages to judge how big a radio set was on these particular ships, assuming that the larger transmitters were on large ships. So making roughly guesses when a battleship versus a destroyer would probably report in. So this is pretty much a guessing game as far as Washington was concerned. And it really didn't help that there was a culture within the Army-Navy at the time that probably impeded much of the dissemination and interpretation of the information that was coming to Washington. So when the Japanese fleet departed for Pearl Harbor, Washington had no clear picture of the Japanese Navy's disposition, and coupled with some subterfuge on the Japanese part, led to the intelligence people in Washington to believe the Japanese fleet was still in home waters. So when the attack came, Washington believed that the only Japanese moves were going to be moves against Britain and Singapore and the Malaysian Peninsula, and possibly the occupation of French and China. So when the 14-part message, which would be the official letter that would be given to Ambassador Hull as the formal severing of Japanese relations with the United States, it was still unclear when the war would actually start. It was assumed that sometime at or after the delivery of this message to Washington, hostilities would erupt. So Washington did issue a general message to all bases in the Pacific that a possible Japanese hostile moves can be possible. And by a strange twist of fate, all but Pearl Harbor was able to receive that message. Atmospheric conditions was making it difficult to get messages to Hawaii, so it was decided to send the message Western Union. Unfortunately, the message was not marked urgent, so this particular war warning arrived 4 hours after attack began. As far as the attack itself, there was a number of missed opportunities. One was the midget sub that tried to enter the harbor. The USS Ward fired upon a suspected Japanese sub trying to enter the harbor. And then there was the upon a point radar station detecting a large flight of aircraft approaching the island north. This was dismissed at the control center in Honolulu as an incoming B-17 flight from the United States. So up to this point, I hope I've demonstrated that there really wasn't a whole lot of information. The United States was unclear to Japanese intentions, naively believing that diplomacy could work. There's also the general belief that by not preparing for war or not building a military would prevent the United States from in a war. The isolationists did have a strong influence on policy. They had controlled the ear of a number of senators and representatives. In many cases, these conspiracies really have no base in history and are somewhat contrived excuses to create a conspiracy. Flynn's December 2nd article in the Chicago Tribune talked about intercepted codes, when in fact all we were reading were diplomatic codes we were not reading Japanese naval codes, so it's somewhat disingenuous. And this is typical of the conspiracy theorists as they blur facts and try to create something that really isn't there to make it sound a lot worse than it was. And it was just a simple fact that the United States was not prepared to go to war. Even amongst military planners, the defense of the Philippines was deemed possible, and having any sort of force on that island would be lost either through the combat losses or surrender. But when it was decided the B-17, who had just come online as a precision bombing platform, changed some of the thinking, and then it became the belief that the Philippines could be defended. But we would see after the attack on Pearl Harbor, the Philippines experienced the same situation and losing the entire air fleet to Japanese air attacks, pretty much crippling U.S. defenses in those islands, and ultimately surrender of the islands to Japan. So in the next installment, I hope to talk more about more much later conspiracies like false flag conspiracies and the more modern versions, and even get into the comparison conspiracies like the 9/11 versus Pearl Harbor analogies.
I can no longer sit back and allow communist infiltration, communist indoctrination, communist subversion, and the international communist conspiracy to sap and impurify all of our precious bodily fluids.
Thank you for listening to A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy. You can find my show notes and links to research material at mikebohler.com. That's MikeBohler.com. Feel free to leave me feedback at feedback@mikebohler.com. If there's a conspiracy you're interested in or wish to contribute more information to this or previous topics, feel free to send that to research@mikebohler.com. A Skeptic's Guide to Conspiracy is a proud member of the Dumbass Media Network. Be sure to check out other great podcasts at dumbassmedia.info. Intro music is Unchained Zarina from danosongs.com. Thank you for listening, and we will see you next time. Thank you. Good night.